Welcome to episode 36 of Canthropod, the Cambridge Anthropology podcast. This is Origin Stories Part 2 by Adam Hindon.
Welcome back to Origin Stories. This is episode 2 of a three-part podcast investigating the processes by which Cambridge anthropologists come into contact with their field sites. In the last episode, I spoke with Sean Lazar, Tom White, and Isa Kavegia about how they ended up working in Bolivia and Argentina, Inner Mongolia, and Japan, respectively. I will begin this episode by sharing my conversation with Dr. Andrew Sanchez about how he came to work in India.
Right, so I mean, I think most people that come to an anthropology PhD, usually they start with an interest in the place and then they figure out the topic. I did it the other way around. So my PhD research was all about class in a company town in India. And the background to that was that I'd grown up, partly at least, in an industrial town on the outskirts of London. So when I was in that town, when I was a teenager, I spent a little bit of time working in factories and warehouses. And I also came from a really working class background, so I was interested in those issues. I was also kind of interested in ethnicity. So at some point when I was an undergraduate student, I think I was in my second year, I had the idea I was going to do a PhD that would be about the relationship between class and ethnicity. And I was thinking of all these working environments around the world where I could do that. So I was kind of interested in industrial towns. So one of the original ideas that I was thinking through was that I might do that research in the US, in Detroit. And that was kind of a big idea I was thinking about for a long time. But what happened is I was being taught by a couple of people as an undergraduate who worked in India. And one of them was Laura Bear. And the other was Jonathan Parry. And through their courses, they kind of gave me the idea that ethnicity and class was a really interesting topic in India. So I started looking into this a bit more. I started thinking about Hindu nationalism and class. And the project just developed from there. And in terms of the specific field site, the place I work in is a town called Jamshedpur. And Laura Bear was the first person to suggest to me that this was a great example of a company town. So that's where it comes from.
Next, I learned about Dr. Elizabeth Turk's story of coming to do fieldwork in Mongolia.
I started fieldwork in 2010-2011. I was a recipient of a Fulbright research scholarship, and I showed up there not knowing anyone, not knowing any part of the language, and just really fell in love with Mongolia, with the people that I met, and the topic that I had chosen to study for the Fulbright. Mm-hmm.
And did you specifically choose Mongolia for the Fulbright, or was that like...
I did. Oh, okay, I did. Okay, yeah. I was right after undergrad, I did the Peace Corps. I volunteered as an environmental education volunteer for the U.S. Peace Corps, which is highly problematic looking back. But as a young, early 20-something, I wanted to see the world, and I didn't want to go to med school just yet or slash ever. Uh-huh. And so I signed up for Peace Corps, went to Romania for 2 years, and then really, really fell out of love with med school and in love with thinking about differences between people and what they find valuable, what aspects of their everyday life is meaningful for them. Mm-hmm. And in Romania, I found in the national park that I was working for, around there were folks who were really interested in natural remedies and natural medicines, mm-hmm. and they knew all these varied names and uses for local plants. Mm-hmm. Flora and fauna, and I thought that was really quite empowering, mm-hmm. and very cool, and knowledge that's been lost in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And so with that interest in mind, and not wanting to go to med school, I applied for a Fulbright scholarship, mm-hmm. And a lot of the, I was looking sort of in like somewhat Buddhist areas. So I was interested in Buddhism as a mm-hmm. younger person. Mm-hmm. So I was looking, okay, China, Japan, sort of Asia, Southeast Asia, South Asia. And the only country that Fulbright would let in without a language requirement mm-hmm. was Mongolia. So I was already interested in Mongolia. The director of Peace Corps at the time, named Ken Goodson, mm-hmm. had done his previous stint in Mongolia, mm-hmm. so for the U.S. Peace Corps in Mongolia, because they're both post-socialist countries and they have something in common, so the narrative goes. Mm-hmm. So Ken had done his previous stint in Mongolia and brought lots of really interesting pictures and stories about his time there, and I just really was captivated by this place. did, you know, online internet researches as you do when you're in your bedroom in Romania thinking about mm-hmm. where you want to go next. And I got it. So I spent a few months between Romania and Mongolia, backpacking through parts of Europe and France, and landed in Romania or in Mongolia September of 2010. So the Fulbright scholar program, or sorry, the project I was doing as a Fulbright scholar had to do with comparative medical systems mm-hmm. And epistemology. So thinking it was a comparative project at the time that was looking at, I think it was women's infertility mm-hmm. from three different medical epistemic perspectives. Mm-hmm. So Western medicine, one, shamanic, and Buddhist. Mm-hmm. And I got to the field, and my advisor at the time named Doflam said, this is way too complex, you got to pick one and do that in 10 months and then mm-hmm. see where you go. He gave me advice of who to visit, who might be an interesting shaman to visit, and who mm-hmm. also heals. And that's when I was like, you know, this is what I want to do. I don't want to practice medicine. Mm-hmm. I want to study the way people approach the body and health, mm-hmm. Diverse understandings of it, mm-hmm. and how they navigate multiple authorities on health and well-being.
Finally, I sat down with Professor Caroline Humphrey to discuss how she came to do fieldwork in Buryatia in what was then the Soviet Union.
My first fieldwork was in Russia, in the far parts of Siberia, in the 1960s. And the only way I could get to the Soviet Union at all at the time was to become a graduate student at Moscow State University. And so when I got there, at that time in Russia, anthropology was not mainly done through fieldwork, so it was a different kind of discipline. But I had been trained in Cambridge, and I sort of insisted, I've got to do fieldwork. And they said, where then? And I had been preparing to go to Yakutia, which is an area in the far northeast of Siberia, very far up in the north. And so I said, I'd like to go to Yakutia. And they said, nyet. That is just not possible. It's dangerous. The people up there are completely wild. You'll never stand the weather. Don't even begin to think about it. You've got to go somewhere else. And so what then happened was, because this was the planned economy, of course, in the Soviet times, the anthropology department also had its plans and was subject to these plans, and I had to get my fieldwork put into the plans, otherwise I wouldn't be able to do it. So I then had a long kind of session with the head of department, and he proposed various places that were in his plans, including urban Uzbekistan, Polish peasants somewhere over in towards the border with Ukraine and stuff. And I said, no, I didn't want to do any of those. And he was quite a nice guy, actually, so I managed to fetch up with Buryatia, which is fairly close to Yakutia, but it's in the south. It's on the border of Mongolia. And so that's where I got into the plan that I could go to that general area. So that was the first step. Buryatia, where I ended up, has been a lot more studied than almost anywhere else in Siberia. And I think one reason for that is that it's on the main line of both roads and rail and everything between Russia and China. Mm. So all travellers go through it. And of course it's culturally very, very sort of influenced by that mid-Asian situation that it's in, with people travelling through it. Just to get onto the next bit of where my actual field work was in Buryatia, that again I had no choice over at all, because what happened was, having agreed to this business of Buryatia, the head of department said, well, we can put it in our plan, but we've got to get the regional authorities out there in Siberia to agree to accept this foreign student who, you know, they will surely think of as a spy. And because this was the Cold War, you remember. And what then happened, one day he came to me and said, there's very good news. There's this woman coming from Buryatia who is very, very high in the sort of KGB, basically the security service over there. And I'm going to invite her over and see if we can get her to agree to accept your visit. So this woman turned up, and I turned on whatever I could in the way of charm and convincing her of my academic interests. And so she looked a bit grumpy and she went away, but in the end she agreed. And so that's how I was able to get to Buryatia, in fact. And then once I did, they had set out a plan for me. So they also have their plans, and this foreign person is going to go to this collective farm and that collective farm, and then is going to visit some railway workers and do this and that. So it was all set out. And there wasn't much I could do about it. I mean, because I didn't know one collective farm from another. I kind of been sitting in Moscow, all the same to me, which one they sent me to. And so I went to those two farms that they proposed, which were obviously some of the most successful in the Republic, because they're not going to send me to a complete failure of a farm. Working in Buryatia, which is, it's on the border of Mongolia, and the people there are Mongolian by ancestry, so they look Mongolian, and they speak a variety of Mongolian language. But they, as they said to me themselves, we're very Russified. And if you want to, because I'd been asking about, you know, the way anthropologists of the 1960s, you can probably imagine, asked all these traditional things about kinship and blah, blah, blah. They said, if you want to know our real culture, you don't want to be here, you want to go to Mongolia, because they're an independent country and they've preserved all these. They have a much more straightforwardly Mongol way of life than we do, because we've just been Russified and they're still nomadic, all this kind of thing. So I thought, ah, yes, that's what I've got to do. So as soon as I got back, in fact, before I finished my PhD, I enrolled in a sort of course, graduate course, and then an MA in Leeds University to study Mongolian language and the history of Mongolia. And so I, apparently this is forbidden, but I didn't realize it at the time. You're not supposed to do another degree while you're doing a Cambridge PhD, but anyway, I did. And so I did 2 years in Leeds working on this thing, on Mongolian. And that, of course, I mean, hardly anybody in Britain did Mongolian. So it was then became very easy to go to Mongolia, or relatively easy.
As we continue on this investigation of the diverse ethnographic experiences of Cambridge anthropologists, it remains clear that field site selection is mediated by a vast array of intended and unintended factors that are driven by, yet also transcend, the personal whims of anthropologists. Notably, interest bred by early encounters with a subject or place is later honed by the perspectives of advisors and sometimes redirected by geopolitical factors of access. How these factors combine together to produce unique stories, however, remains as varied as the resulting ethnographies themselves. Thanks very much for listening to Origin Stories and to Camp Therapod.